Welcome to our Friday Five Live podcast hosted by Meg Foster. Meg has spent 20 years in higher education focused on student success initiatives and working in areas such as orientation, faculty development, online learning, student leadership, and first-year initiatives.
Well, welcome everybody. It is Friday, and so fun Friday. We get to do our Friday Five Live. Today, we're discussing dual enrollment trends, and I do have up on our screen, we've got another complimentary opportunity to come in and learn about teaching first-year experience classes to dual enrollment learners. So if that is something you'd like to explore more with us after the Thanksgiving holiday on December the 8th at 1 o'clock, we'll be hosting that webinar and excited to have that conversation. That is a topic really that is near and dear to my heart because that is what I teach. So, and I often have dual enrollment students in that environment. But welcome everybody. We are here today to talk about the future of dual enrollment, national trends, and kind of what comes next. Just as a couple of friendly housekeeping reminders, first of all, please do use the chat. That makes my heart so happy. And if you've been with us before, you know that we love hearing from folks. I know Aurelia's already put, we'll make sure we keep putting relevant links and things in the chat for you, but just make sure you select everyone from the drop-down menu so we can all see your questions, your comments, your thoughts, or let us know where you're listening from today. I think Jasmine wins the award all the way from Hawaii. Maybe she's the farthest away person this morning, but we're thrilled to have folks just from all over joining us as we talk about dual enrollment trends. And we are so fortunate, and we had tried to do this in September, and Aurelia is out on the road a lot, and you know, unfortunately, sometimes that creates sickness. So excited that you could join us now to talk about trends. So we are joined by a subject matter expert and researcher in dual enrollment from the Center of CCRCs. Share it with me.
Yeah, the Community College Research Center at Teachers College, Columbia University. It's very long, so that, no worries.
But it's a lot of C's, and I always never get those right. But thank you for enlightening me there. So we have Aurelia Garcia-Tulla, who has joined us today. Just a passionate enthusiast about the topic of dual enrollment, and not to blow her entire cover, but she is a former dual enrollment learner herself, and so comes at this work with just so many different lenses. So Aurelia, thank you so much for joining us today. We are just thrilled, and it's great to see people jumping in from all over, as I hope that you can see, ready and excited to learn from you. So as if you've been on one of our podcasts in the past, you know that I always prepare a list of questions for us, but we love your questions. So whether you're from Ohio University or Howard College, throw in your questions. Into the chat as well, and I will weave those into our conversation. So to kind of kick us off, I thought about this sort of trends topic. You know, we're seeing huge growth, so I'm guessing that's kind of one of the trends, but wondering kind of what are some major trends that you're seeing nationally in dual enrollment? And then if you'd gaze into your crystal ball for just a second and tell us, where do you see things kind of going in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, thank you so much. And honestly, I'm so excited. I keep seeing the chat blowing up in so many different areas. And I'm like, wow, thank you all so much for joining. Okay, let me get back to the question. So what are the major trends that we've been seeing? At CCRC, we've been studying dual enrollment for a super long time. And I was also a former dual enrollment student. So I feel like when you mentioned the crystal ball, I'm just like, what can I foresee? So I think the first thing is we've been seeing this shift from programs of privilege and random acts of dual enrollment to a focus on access to whom and access to what. And we are really both fueled by those phrases at CCRC, but also we are continuing to do more work because the work on dual enrollment just doesn't really end. There's so much to learn. There's so much to dive deeper into. I'll explain deep later. But I really wanna talk a little bit more about those access to whom, access to what phrases. So when we refer to access to whom, we mean who's getting access to these courses and these programs. So historically, there have been several underserved populations that we've seen in the research, that being Black students, Hispanic students, also low-income students, English language learners, and students with disabilities. And what's even more interesting about that is that these students, despite them being underserved, the research shows that it benefits them. And so we at CCRC have really just been taking like an extra close attention to what's going on with these students and what are they getting access to. So now flipping on its head to access to what, when we types of courses are students taking, and are they high quality experiences that allow them to engage in this coursework and be exposed to what it's like to be a college student? I know in my experience, I don't know if I would have approached college even the same way or like had a view of like what college even worked and was like without being a dual enrollment student. So it's especially important that, I mean, students like me, but students nationally, we are making sure that they're having a high quality experience where they're not just like, hey, this is just a random class I'm taking, but they're really lighting the fire to further education after high school. To flip onto my crystal ball, I really see dual enrollment continuing to grow. And that's just based on the data that we've seen. Recently, new IPEDS data came out where there's now over 2.8 million students nationally taking dual enrollment courses. And that was just in the academic year of 2023-2024. But over the past decade, it's doubled. And so being that it's really doubled, especially in the community college sector, we're just increasingly thinking about like, how can we learn more about this population? How can we raise more awareness, especially after they transfer? I wrote a blog at Inside Higher Ed called Stealth Transfer, referring to like what happens to students who are dual enrollment students, and then now they're former, but now they're at a university, and now they're like really incognito. So I think there'll just be more attention in general as this population continues to grow. NACEP, which is the National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment Partnerships, just recently had their annual conference, which we at CCRC attend every year because we just love learning more about dual enrollment, and we're just also huge fans and supporters of what they do. But recently they've had record attendance within their conferences, and that's across K through 12 community colleges and universities. And I think the last thing before I keep rambling, is that I just see more questions being asked about this population. So what about student outcomes? What about the ROI of getting a credential or a degree or a workforce something in high school? A lot more questions on mental health, especially coming out of COVID. How do we better provide wraparound supports for these students? And then how do we use dual enrollment as a way to engage students that would have never thought about going to college, especially in this time where more and more students are questioning the value of in higher education? How do we reinvigorate them and get them excited for college as an opportunity for not just the most privileged students, but for all? So I hope that answers the first question.
Well, and it gives me like a million other questions that I love the focus on, not the, because I do think we've seen like historically those random acts of dueling, right? Like I see that all the time in our school system. And there are such intentional programs that are being built out, but I know that those can be really complex, and we're going to get to that, I think, you know, as we kind of move through. But I really love this emphasis and focus on how do we make sure that these opportunities exist for all students, because we know the benefit of this work and what that can mean. But then that's complex too, right? Because we're potentially putting students on a path, right? I think of all the guided pathways work that I know CCRC has been involved in that too. And so, you know, how do we put them on these paths so that they understand? And then I think about the communication flows with families, and you may have first generation learners, and I mean, you have a lifetime of research here, I think. As these programs continue to grow.
There's definitely so much to look into. And I think that's why at CCRC, we're always asking questions to the field and trying to make sure that our research is both responsive, but also trying to answer these like very high priority questions that folks are having. And then I can answer questions about certain specific controversial things as well from my personal dual enrollment perspective. Just because a lot of the times when we think about serving all students, we do think about like, what about these students that are stuck on a certain pathway? Or like, what happens if they didn't really want to do this in the first place? And I think what we've learned at CCRC is that a lot of the time these students don't even realize this opportunity exists. And even if it's, I see the like free of charge in the chat, it was free for me when I took these courses, but in certain states, sometimes there isn't that opportunity, but in other cases too, it will be that even if it is free, a student might not even realize that it exists. So I can talk about the strategies later, but
yeah, no, it's exciting to see some people putting in the chat that, you know, some districts in their area, institutions are offering these dual enrollment programs, you know, free of charge to students. Again, I know that's a layer of complexity. I mean, these things do also cost money. I mean, we have, you know, to pay teachers and things like that. So it's wonderful to see the access, but I just know that behind the scenes, right, it's not just poof, magic, right? There's a lot of hard work and a lot of negotiation that goes in to making those opportunities exist. So, and maybe that's a nice kind of thought to transition us into that next question around, you know, you're so wise, and I'm always careful whenever we talk about dual enrollment. I always want to bring up the fact that, you know, the success outcomes are quite impressive. And I'm sure you can quote to me all the statistics. But at the same time, like, I know there are these historically underserved student populations that sometimes struggle to get, you know, access for lots of different reasons. And I'm thinking about, you know, in my state, I mentioned Northern Virginia Community College, right? They did a massive overhaul of their dual enrollment program because it initially really was serving high achieving resource students who were college bound anyway, right? And they wanted to revision a program that served all of their student population, right? All of those counties in areas that they serve. So tell us about, as in your research, kind of what strategies are you seeing that the school systems or institutions are using that have been really particularly impactful? Like, if we could have like two or three takeaways, you're like, if you just do these things, the magic will happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think getting to the magic really does require partnership. So I have to preface that before I even mention anything. But we have been doing research at CCRC for a long time from a lot of different angles of dual enrollment, that being from funding to the student experience. But specifically, when we're thinking about strategies that have been most effective to really supporting getting more students in this program and on a pathway and successful from all different backgrounds, we have been doing this research called DEEP. So I kind of mentioned that before, but it stands for Dual Enrollment Equity Pathways. And what it is it's a research-based framework for reform that pulls from prior research, like you mentioned, on guided pathways. What does it look like when they're implemented in dual enrollment programs? What can be replicated from early college high schools, which we've known from the research that has been successful for students? But what can that look like when they're serving students attending comprehensive and Title I high schools? And then what is already known about effective and equitable dual enrollment practices that we can really use to create a framework for reform that's responsive to the field? And so the DEEP framework actually outlines four practices. So I'm adding one more thing to your three.
Yeah,
we do love a four. And those four practices are, first, outreach to underserved students in schools; two, alignment to college degrees and careers in fields of interest to students; three, early career and academic exploration, advising and planning; and four, high quality college instruction and academic support. And these practices really do complement each other, but they're all used to intentionally lead to either a workforce program aligned to a high wage, high demand career for students after high school, a community college transfer program aligned to a 4-year university major, or entry directly into a baccalaureate major at a 4-year institution. I speak to DEEP a lot, not just because I am part of the research, but also because I personally think that it's a really interesting, and I honestly, it doesn't feel new, even though it is new, way To redesign dual enrollment to support all students, with especially when we're thinking about how do we get our students that would never think about college, would have not known this was an opportunity for them, are doing the deep research. What we've done is we've gone to high school and community college partnerships in Texas and Florida, specifically Title I comprehensive high schools. And we've done field research, we've spoken to students. And so not only have we looked at the research, the prior research to be able to get to this framework, but we have tested it. So I'll stop there, but we can also expand.
I mean, that's just, and I love that you're testing it in these environments. Like, I have kids at Title I school. So, you know, I'm a big believer in the work that gets done there and the communities that are there. And so what I hear, like, I love these four pillars. So I'm just going to read out my scrabbled notes. So deep. So we're talking about outreach to students. So that communication piece, which is so critical. Students need to understand these opportunities exist. I'm sure that's kind of folding in parents as well into that, making sure that there are opportunities to align career major pathway. Early academic advising, career advising, exposure to that, which I'm going to get to in a second because there was a good question about that. And then finally, that high quality instruction and academic support. And I thought this question here that Chris posted was such a great one, that you talked about stealth students, right? And I'm as a parent of somebody who's going to graduate with an associate's in social science, I'm very cognizant of the fact that I'm sending an 18-year-old off to college who technically could then take junior and senior level classes. And I love my kid, but he will not have the emotional maturity to do that, right? He may have some of the academic skills. He will, but, you know, there's a difference between the thought process of an 18-year-old and a 20-year-old in a traditional setting. So Chris's great question is, when students are entering with a bunch of credit, they often have to make that decision about major earlier. Any ideas around, and this is that kind of maybe second or third pillar around it deep, but that early career advising piece, like how are people weaving that in when you've got so much academic coursework that's really rigorous?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you to Chris for asking it, but also thank you for repeating it. I think what we've seen in our deep research, I'll speak to that, but I'll also speak from my personal experience being someone who graduated with 68 credits from high school. It was definitely a lot. And we now, I also lead our dual enrollment squad here at CCRC, which I'll mention too. We've seen in the field is that we've seen folks showcasing dual enrollment to support this exploration of courses. So I think one thing in general that we know about dual enrollment is that if we're getting students into college courses earlier, especially those who may not know about college before doing this opportunity, we really have to rethink how are we onboarding them to these courses and in what manner. A lot of those being those student success courses is being a great way to get students really interested in how can we get them to understand different majors? What is financial aid? What are these other things that they may face? And also, what are all these different majors that they could earn, careers that they could be interested in doing after high school? We've also seen folks coordinating these advising roles across sectors. So specifically, that may be a co-advising model where you get folks that are both hired by the K-12 and the college to both support advising. But on top of that, when they're doing that advising, they're doing checkpoint advising. So to Chris's point of, you know, by the time you end up going to a baccalaureate program, if you are wanting to change your major, there are a ton of implications, especially excess credits. But while they're in high school, we can do efforts such as making sure that we have credit milestones. So checking in with students from 0, 5, 10, 15, depending on how many that they're getting in high school, to check in and see, do they still want to do this? Are they still interested in this pathway? Are they still interested in this program? Do they know where their credits are going to go to and how they'll transfer? And do they know the difference between in-state and out-of-state? A lot of these like things that I'm saying aloud are in our resources on the Linktree and on the CCRC website. I think they're in a publication called What Dual Enrollment Students Want, where it really outlines how we can connect deep to what students are experiencing. But it is a very relevant question. And I guess to the flip side, talking from my experience, and the squad. So at CCRC, we are continuing to do our deep research, and a part of our new grant was to do a dual enrollment student advisory panel so we can make sure that our research directly responds to what the lived experience of students is. And in that, I think one thing that I've heard from our students, but also it's true to my heart, is that we know that dual enrollment, when you're taking these courses, you will struggle. It's kind of a reality that these courses are going to be harder. That doesn't mean that it's not meant for you. And I think as personally doing it, I remember being starting dual enrollment and just being like, oh, wait, I could be this, I could be that, I could be this. And I kept dropping a lot of courses within my first semester. But my advisor checked in with me very early before the ad drop deadline. But my advisors made sure, and the faculty and the staff and anyone on campus was like, if you need a hand or if you need to just talk, they were there. And so one thing that has always reigned true within doing this research, but also through the lived student experience, is that even though students may and will struggle within this program, there are ways that educators, peers, other resources can really help students succeed and know that this is a program that can be met for them. I hope that answers Chris's question.
Yeah, that's great. And I put the Linktree link again into our chat so everybody can have access. And Chris was kind enough to share the particular piece that came out a couple weeks ago for the DEEP model. So that was awesome. We've had a message from somebody who's working in the transfer area in Texas and said this is something we're especially, you know, doing a deep look at. Great tie-in, because I know, you know, just published content around career technical education and dual enrollment, and that's a real area of excitement and interest. So yeah, anything you want to, and I think that's kind of a nice tie into this idea about the sustained strong partnerships. You kind of mentioned that as you were talking about strategies for connecting with underserved students, and that, you know, some districts have like these folks who kind of walk the space between the high school and the college, supporting students and helping them navigate these processes. I know not for all of this, that's not feasible for everybody, right? Like, again, I think, you know, this podcast is super, unfortunately, we didn't get magic wands, right, in the creation of this. But yeah, so what are some of the things that you're seeing that are really helping those partnerships? Because I think that piece is just seems really, really critical to me.
Yeah. So I guess before I get into the partnerships, I do want to shout out two more resources to transfer. I would say to check out our Stealth Transfer and our Lost in Transfer blogs. Both of those speak to what happens to dual enrollment students after high school and like questions that we have for the field. And then also a good resource would be Transfer Nation. They are just a community of transfer practitioners and educators that are really interested in both the work we do at CCRC, but also transfer in general. So I just wanted to put those out there.
Thank you.
Lots of partnerships. That's a little bit more transfer specific, but at CCRC, we always kind of bridge the gap between both of them. A lot of our dual enrollment team also supports transfer work. So anyways, moving on to partnerships. What we've seen in the field is a lot of these really, really, really strong partnerships, they're using dual enrollment as a part of their mission or part of their strategic goal. I think one really cool example is the Alamo Colleges District, their 29 by 29 goal, which is, I think it's 29,000 dual enrollment students within all of their district by 2029. But they're also kind of they're co-offering and co-talking about this with their goal to eradicate poverty within the county. So it's not just a goal of increasing the number of dual enrollment students, but it's increasing access and intentionality and what's going on within that district, and really taking a deeper dive into the data to see what students and what districts and what areas are most underserved. Again, on the Linktree, wrote a blog about Alamo Colleges just because of the awesome work that they're doing. So feel free to check that out. But things that we've also seen is folks really going from this, what we call the conventional model, which was that random acts and programs of privilege that I kind of hinted to before, to now this deeper approach, which is a more intentional, accessible approach to dual enrollment. And so within that, folks are seeing dual enrollment as more of a pathway for all students, not just those who are from their most privileged communities or who are already on a university-bound pathway. And they're also realizing that dual enrollment students are a population on their campuses. I know that sounds very like basic and probably a little peculiar, but a lot of the times dual enrollment is making up a huge percentage, especially at community colleges campuses, that being in the double digits for some states, according to the recent IPEDS data, but they're not always being tracked and they're not always getting the dedicated resources that they needed. So at NACEP and when we're at other conferences or what, even when we're talking with practitioners, we hear Office of One or Office of Two, or if we get really lucky, Office of Five, and that being the staff that's supporting dual enrollment students. But folks in really strong partnerships are thinking about how can we use other resources across the college and across K through 12, leveraging incentives and wins to really be able to provide dual enrollment in a way that's sustainable for both sides. And they're also thinking about how can we continuously keep talking about this? So it's not enough to just talk about reinventing and redesigning dual enrollment during one professional development event. It really is a part of how do we think about our shared advising model if we want that? How do we do professional development with faculty and staff and students and former dual enrollment students? And how do we engage the voices that we don't hear as much? In order to sustain these partnerships. I think the last thing also is industry partners. They are also sometimes forgotten about within this space, and they can also provide support to us of what do we need to be offering? What kind of courses are best that will make sure that our students are getting high demand, high wages after they graduate, not just from high school, but from a baccalaureate program, and really come back to their community to support it if they want to. So, yeah.
Think about, you know, the example of Alamo College and thinking about, I mean, I just love that thinking about dual enrollment in the context of what does this mean for our community, right? And raising our community, right? And standard of living and all of those really important questions and conversations that putting it into that perspective, right? Of what does this mean, not in the short term for the students, but in the long term for our larger community text and then context, and then thinking about, yes, and how do we weave in our industry partners? I mean, I know like locally, there's been a lot of discussion of we do not have enough dental hygienists in Virginia, just so you know. And so there's an interest in growing dental hygiene program, career technical in our school system that will have like college credit, right? It is going to be a dual enrollment program. But then because that's serving this huge industry need that we have, which are, you know, fantastic, well-paid. I mean, y'all, if you know a dental hygienist and they want to come to Virginia, they can really truly demand their hours and their salary because that is the kind of need that we have for them. So really love.
Yeah. It reminds me also just about the outreach aspect of DEEP and how we can even look into our like local churches, our local Boys and Girls Club to see maybe these are different ways that we can engage parents and families to know that this is an opportunity for them and that it can also lead to ways that they can support their communities. Because there are a lot of students, especially those who, you know, want to be at home and want to be able to support their families and that are coming from underserved communities, they want to be able to give back. And so dual enrollment can be used as a lever for that when redesigned and done well.
Curious, this is a connection question, a bridge question to the next one. But, you know, you mentioned that you're seeing this kind of growth of where before maybe like higher ed institutions might have had like the one dual enrollment person, right? And now maybe they're expanding into teams. If you could wave your magic wand that we did not remember to issue you, like what might that look like in a really effective and meaningful way at a 2 or 4 year institution?
So that is a very hard question, because I think there's a lot of other external factors that we want to be cognizant of, such as like state and federal funding or like capacity or things that are already occurring to support, let's say, traditional age students. And so I can't say that I have a magic wand of what would be wonderful and great and awesome, but I do think that our study that just came out on community college business models is a really interesting report to see how colleges nationally under different funding structures are thinking about how they're reorganizing, reallocating, and redistributing staff across partnerships in order to support dual enrollment programs. I would say from a personal point of view, it's really great for dual enrollment students to have a point of contact. At least so they can know that this is my person where I am going to get the information that I need that is also factual. This information occurs whether it be in dual enrollment, transfer, or just being a regular student on college campuses. So assigning a point of contact, multiple points of contact if you have the resources, but that are all well trained across different areas of dual enrollment, concurrent enrollment, dual credit, whatever you want to call it in your state, but for those different models, whether it be in the high school or at the community college or online, it really does help students. But unfortunately, I cannot tell you what the best model would be because it's so specific state to state and it's so different. So.
Love that piece of everybody needs. I mean, and that's the research that we know about college success in general, right? If we have that sense of belonging, if we can identify who our person is that we go to, right? Who's that reliable source, then we're more likely to be successful and we're more likely to be retained. So,
Yeah, I actually on that same report, we do have a tool because we love including applied tools that folks can really use and dig into. I believe we call it an inquiry and action tool, where folks can go through and figure out who is staffed on their dual enrollment programs, how much time is allocated, and see what is best for them while also being able to think about how does this align with the DEEP framework, which I mentioned earlier. So I just recommend both if you're interested in that report, reading it, but also clicking on those tools and seeing ways that you can really do this analysis of your own college or partnership.
You guys put out such, I mean, it's very accessible content. Like we can all read it and I encourage you strongly if you're listening in, follow CCRC on LinkedIn. I feel like you do a great job of posting information there. Jessica has asked a question to expand on question three. Curious about recommendations for strong and sustainable partnerships between community colleges serving dual enrollment students and academic universities at units at universities receiving these students. So, where the community college, their students dual enrollment, and then they're going to be taking those credits, if I understand Jessica correctly, and moving on to a four-year college or university. That's a great question.
Sorry,
So,
I'm going to repeat the question one more time. Just
yeah. So, curious about recommendations for strong, sustainable partnerships between the community college serving the dual enrollment student and academic university units at universities receiving the student. So,
yes.
yeah.
Okay, so I think I'll provide it from more of a student perspective first and then kind of flip it on the other side. In our publication on what dual enrollment students want, under the last want, what we found was that students really want to learn more about how do they finance, how do they fund, and what do they do when they transfer their credits after high school to college. And under the recommendations on those, and I think also in our blogs and Inside Higher Ed about self-transfer, we do talk about having and reminding students to keep their syllabi just in case they need to go back and prove that their course was equivalent. I want to make sure I'm going to answer this, but if I'm not understanding it correctly, feel free to cut me off. But we do encourage students to do that. We're also encouraging parents and families to continuously think about how are we engaging them to understand what the transfer process looks like. And really amazing partnerships are thinking about all those factors. They're thinking about the student, the parent and the family, the faculty, whether that be at the community college or on the college or online. They're thinking about the staff that's involved, how many, who's involved, the awareness that they have, the information they're getting, and they're continuously having these conversations. So I think the biggest takeaway, and I guess the biggest magic wand thing that I can think of, is they're reducing the amount of misinformation that's going through all of these different constituencies, whether it be from K through 12, 2 year to 4 year. And they're also, in the case that there is misinformation, we're thinking of things like holding on to your syllabi, reminding students to think about like what, how, and who are their credits transferring to, and continuously having those conversations with advisors if they change their mind about their program. I hope that answers the question.
I think it does. And I mean, I think Jessica's asking a good one. And I know that I'm certainly seeing a lot of really exciting conversations happen regionally between like 2 year and 4 year institutions in my state, where and sometimes that kind of comes from the top levels, and sometimes that percolates up from like, you know, advisors who are doing that work or working with transfer students and saying, hey, you know, it would be really helpful if we had semester meetings, you know, with our counterparts at the 4 year institutions or with, you know, the business program, because we don't think our students are maybe, they're struggling to get admitted or whatever. I mean, I think, you know, not being afraid to open up those pathways of conversation wherever you are in your system, administratively, you know, don't be afraid just because your title is advisor, right, that you can't reach out and start some of that communication pieces. So, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I think also a good reference to shout out the Alamo Colleges again, they have an annual dual credit conference. That's what they call dual enrollment down there in Texas. But it's only, they invite external folks, but it's for their colleges and for their K through 12 superintendents, anyone who's involved in dual enrollment regionally, to be able to discuss some of these key priorities, practices, and things that are going on within the district. It's really awesome. They've been doing it annually in October. I've been there a couple times just to see what it looks like. And I think we mentioned it in our blog as well. So if you have any questions on how to do that in the future, again, reach out anytime. So,
yeah, I mean, and potentially that's not costing a ton of money, right, for an institution to host that sort of event. I mean, it doesn't have to be like big glamour, right? It can be just a very intentional opportunity, come together, you know, and share. So I love that. Okay. We only have, I know, 8 minutes. Time goes by really fast on these things. Would love to know how are institutions measuring the success of programs beyond, yay, we have a 20% increase, you know, this year, because I know this can be, is it just the success metrics of academics? I would hope not. You know, yeah.
Yeah. So I would say in two ways. So I will dig a little bit back into the data just because we love talking about it, but in a different way, that being that folks are using data on what classes students are taking, where they're going after high school, how and what's going on with their credits when they're transferring, but intentionally disaggregated by race, income, and other external factors. To inform these regular professional development activities that include K through 12, community college, university, and sometimes industry partners, that has been a really interesting way, an innovative way that we've seen folks in the field really measuring success within their programs. But the second thing being, folks are really asking what dual enrollment students want. We've seen this in the field, and we've seen it a lot at our at NASEP when folks are talking about it, but specifically SESE offers this dual enrollment survey of student engagement. It's called the DESE. And if colleges and their partnerships want to opt in, they can always reach out. But it's a really great resource and tool for educators to better understand what students are experiencing on their campuses and also look at what's going on nationally. I think also to shout out what dual enrollment students want, that publication again, if you're interested in how can we connect deep reform, which is redesigning dual enrollment to be more equitable, to be more intentional, to be more accessible for all students, I'd really encourage you to read this report. I'd encourage you to read our Deep Insights report, because it really does outline how can we continue to do this work within different funding atmospheres, different student demographics? And what can we ask our students to be able to evaluate what's going on within these programs? Those are some of the two ways that I've seen that have been really interesting in the field.
Betsy had a dual enrollment student equivalent. That's awesome. We've gotten a couple of questions in the chat. Amy shared, I find that reporting on grade success helps for buy-in with faculty and student support staff on my campus. There's a misconception that high school students are struggling and are failing classes. And my data indicates that they're doing better sometimes than our first time in college students. So it's an interesting observation, Amy. Thanks for sharing that. Or really, any comments on that?
Yeah, I think it's super important. Buy-in is always a question that we're getting asked. And in our Deep Insights report, we outline a couple of different ways that we've heard about generating buy-in within the field. But also, I think it speaks to the fact that when we disaggregate the data, different things pop up out of it. So when we look specifically at only, let's say, Hispanic low-income students, like myself, we may see that they have different outcomes or different things that they're really benefiting from or classes that they're doing better in, which can really help inform what best practices that we should be doing on our campuses. So yeah, I definitely agree. There's different ways that we can do with buy-in and different ways we can use data to really support and understand what we're doing.
So we had this kind of last question about, which I think we've touched on a little bit already, these idea of best practices for kind of, you know, because dual enrollment students, I think, are unique, right? We're helping high school students understand the transition into a college environment, right, as they're taking these courses in high school. But then we also have, I think, that responsibility kind of as we're sending them off to that next step, helping them sort of as they transition. So, you know, any kind of final thoughts or words around, you know, supporting students? Are there kind of gaps that you've seen? I don't know. Or areas that you're like, okay, now as we focus on kind of the future, the next 5 to 10 years in this growth areas, here's where I'd recommend.
Yeah, I think I'll speak from our dual enrollment squad perspective. So that's our 11 dual, current and former dual enrollment students across the nation who are helping inform our research, as well as just from the student experience. A couple of our students have mentioned how important a community is when it comes to dual enrollment. And having that community within the high school, so creating clubs or organizations where dual enrollment students can share their experiences with each other, but then also once they go on to a college or a university, being able to continue those types of communities or affinity spaces where students can really share and talk about their experiences, even if they didn't go through the same program. So even if they didn't do an early college high school, they went to a comprehensive or they took 5 credits or they took 60. So we've heard that a lot from our students in the dual enrollment squad. What we've seen also in the field is really a lot of questions about this, but also a lot of how do we make sure our students are best informed before they transfer? So thinking about kind of exit advising, like how do we talk about financial aid? How do we make sure that students, well, from the beginning when they're starting dual enrollment, have a map of what they're planning on doing and where they want to go, but also that they're informed of things like excess credits, they're informed of things about financial aid. We definitely see as this type of like exit advising, also in conjunction with checkpoint advising, to support this transition post high school into community college or into the workforce or into university. The biggest gap that I see continues to be the whole concept of stealth transfer. There just isn't as much research as there should be on what happens to former dual enrollment students once they get to a university. What are they experiencing? What are they going through? And specifically when we think about how are we tagging them? Like, are they considered transfer students? Are they considered first years? And what can we do as educators to ensure that these students don't get lost in transfer, as we say, and make sure that they're getting the supports that they needed because they have this accelerated experience. That isn't to diminish all the other experiences that folks are going through once they go through transfer. But we know that with this population continuing to rise, it's just going to become more apparent on our four-year campuses.
Love this, the importance of community. You know, I know my son's program is a cohort model very intentionally, you know, because of that need for community. And then, and Kristen has said, interesting idea, an affinity group for dual enrollment students once they enroll at four-year schools. They're not quite first years, not quite transfers. They're first years on our campuses because they don't know, right? They're brand new to that space. And so honoring that while also honoring the fact that they may have some more comfortability potentially in a college, navigating a college classroom, but still remembering they have to learn all the resources that are at this new institution. How it's no different than I worked with transfer students for years, right? And that idea of, I know how college works, I just don't know how it works here. And really being comfortable with that kind of gap. I love that idea of how do we then honor this kind of new emerging, because it is going to be a big group. I mean, when we think about that 5 to 10 year landscape space, I mean, 30% of the college students where I teach are dual enrollment learners. I mean, it is just a growing population. So what is that going to look like at our institutions, you know, in the future? So much to ponder.
I know. I feel like it's a question at this point of what students on our campuses don't have prior credit before they're coming into a college or university, because it's just going to continue to grow. And at this point, it appears that a lot of students are coming in with some type of experience with college before. So how do we support that? And how do we amplify and encourage this experience and hold value to it, being that it probably won't slow down? So yeah, it's a lot to ponder, a lot to think about, and why we're constantly doing this research. So
Well, thank you. Oh, yes. So, you know, I think we've at least solidified several more research studies for your future. Like, there's an endless supply of questions to ask here in this space.
Yes,
I just wanted to say thank you so much for coming on and talking with us today. I have taken a page of notes. You've given us a lot of wonderful resources to look at. We will make sure that everyone has access both to the recording and to the many links that we shared out today with regards to CCRC's continuing depth of research with regards to dual enrollment. And really, we just really thank you so much for your willingness to come on our podcast and talk dual enrollment with us. And I hope we'll make this an annual thing. You can keep updating us, because it's such exciting content and such exciting questions that you all are asking. So thank you for all the work that you're doing.
No, thank you all. Thank you for providing us this platform to be able to share our research. And yeah, please stay engaged. I always tell educators, practitioners, anyone who's just interested, that our Linktree has our contact information, but it's constantly being updated because, as we mentioned earlier, we're constantly doing more research. So yeah, just excited to be here. And thank you all so much. And especially the chat. Thank you all so much for the great questions.
Great questions in the chat. So just as a couple of friendly housekeeping things, next Friday, we're going to have, I think, a good podcast to wrap up this kind of fall season around caregiver fatigue in higher ed. We know that it's a real thing. And so we've got Dr. Shannon Cooper joining us to talk about her ways, strategies we can support one another as we move into out of the fall semester and into the spring semester. And then last, there'll be a survey that pops up at the end today. Please do fill out that survey. It helps us to collect information about topics that you would like to see in the future on our podcast. And special today, I guess, because it's the November season, if somebody fills that out, one lucky winner gets a gift card. So yay, that's a little nice thing in the month of November. So know that we're thankful for you all. Hope you'll join us next week. And really thank you again so much for your time today. We really appreciate it. Take care, everybody. Have a great weekend. We hope there's time for rest and renewal in your week ahead.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Friday 5 Live is brought to you by Innovative Educators. Innovative Educators offers 6 online services for your onboarding support and training needs. Visit us at innovativeeducators.org to see how we can support your student success initiatives.